From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, schools need money to make them more secure from shooters. That's especially true for rural schools.
If something bad were to happen, the response time would be not very great.
Prisoners have been striking, holding sit-ins, and so forth to protest conditions.
No one's asking to get out. They're asking to simply be treated as human beings inside.
Meanwhile, Governor Rick Snyder is changing applications for state jobs by dropping the box that asks whether you've been convicted of a felony.
I want to encourage employers to do the right thing to hopefully bring them in and hopefully get them great-paying careers.
And we talk with our Friday commentators about the Promote the Vote proposal headed to the ballot in November.
The one part of it that causes aggravation among Republicans is going to be the same day voter registration.
All of that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, Governor Rick Snyder announced that he's directing state agencies to change work applications by removing the so-called felony box. That's the question asking if an applicant has ever been charged or convicted of a felony. There are some exceptions, and here to explain that is Governor Snyder. Why are you making this change?
Well, it's the right thing to do, Lester. I think it's a great opportunity to continue to do what I call smart justice. It's not about being hard or soft on justice, it's doing the right thing, and this is an excellent opportunity to help people reenter society. They've served their time with us, and we want them to be successful, and we happen to be in a job market that has lots of openings, and so I want to encourage employers to do the right thing to hopefully bring them in and hopefully get them great-paying careers along with other Michiganders, and I'm doing what we can at the state level to encourage that.
This also gets rid of the felony box for people applying for occupational licensing from the state. These are not state employees, but people who need a license to pursue their career. Why that change?
The same rationale. So basically what I can do administratively, and I'd love to partner with my legislative partners on doing more, but a couple things I can do directly is to issue an executive directive to state departments that work for me with respect to their hiring practices to drop the felony box. And also working with the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, which is part of my responsibility, to have them administratively remove that where there isn't legislation to say it has to be asked.
There are certain exceptions to these licensings, particularly health occupations. Why is that?
There's actually state and federal laws that would need to be changed to allow that to happen. And again, that's where I am very open to having a discussion with both the state legislature, or at some point I hope the federal government looks at this as an issue, because I think times have changed, and I think it's important that we be proactive. And it's showing up in Michigan. We actually have our lowest recidivism rate in history. Our prison population's down dramatically, and don't we want to see that continue on a positive path?
Yeah, there's been this national movement to ban the felony box on employment applications. Why do you think this issue is getting attention, not just from advocates, but from business groups?
Well, I think they're looking for people. And I think if you look at what we're doing, one of the great achievements we've had is we created something called the Vocational Village. In two of our facilities, we're adding a third, where we're actually doing this occupational training to turn out people in carpentry, many other skill sets, computer integrated manufacturing, and to put them to work. And it's working well.
This is for ex-offenders?
This is for people while they're still in the facility that will be coming out. We literally have employers now coming to the facilities to do interviews, potentially do offer letters before people even exit the facility. And isn't that a great answer to say they've gotten the training while we still are with us, and then they can come out and go to work the next day that they leave the institution.
Some people see some incongruencies in what you're doing, because earlier this year you enacted a law which banned counties and cities from ban the felony box ordinances that would have restricted private companies. Why is the private sector hiring different from the public sector employment or licensing for private sector?
Well, again, we want to continue to work on this. So what I'd say is I need to continue working with my legislative partners, and that's where I'd love to have a broader discussion about where else we could remove it.
Yeah, I'm trying to get to the motivation. Are you making government the shining example and hoping the private sector and the legislature follow suit, but at the same time banning communities who want to be more assertive about this felony box on work applications? What's the message here?
Well, again, it's about being a good role model to say, I think from my position, I think it's a good thing to do, and I think this is an opportunity to show that and encourage private people, and I would encourage, again, legislators to come back to say where else we can do it in any part of our economy.
I got one final question. Who are you going to vote for in the race for Michigan governor?
I'll decide that when that day comes. I'll go on the ballot box just like the rest of us, and we get a chance to do that in private.
Rick Snyder is the governor of the state of Michigan. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Great to be with you. Take care.
All right, let's talk some politics with our Friday commentators. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. And Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. So a federal appeals court has ruled no straight ticket voting in November. Some people will shrug and say, good, people will actually research the candidates, which I find a little optimistic. Others say, good, they actually might get to the nonpartisan parts of the ballot. And others say this is voter suppression by increasing the already huge lines of voters waiting for hours in the state's urban areas. Vicki, what do you think of it?
I think straight party ticket voting is a great option, especially in Michigan, where we do not have early voting or no reason absentee voting, which is what happens in most states that have done away with the straight party ticket voting measure. So I'm really disappointed. The original injunction on this came from a federal court judge, Judge Gershwin Drain, who claimed that it was disproportionately going to affect African-American communities because of the use of heavy use of straight party ticket voting. And I agree. I think it's a bad idea. The other two times that this was tried in Michigan, in 1964 and in 2001 and 2, the voters overturned the ban.
Ken, what's your take on no straight ticket voting?
You know, I'm agnostic about it, although I did vote to ban it when I was in the Senate. I just don't think it's going to have much of an impact. The appellate court, the most recent court decision, basically said this is a public policy question to be decided by the legislature, not a constitutional question to be decided by the courts. But as I said, it's just the recent court opinion, and that could change. I just don't think in the 40-plus states that don't allow straight ticket voting, it has much impact either way.
I should note that in the Detroit News today, attorneys for the Michigan State A. Philip Randolph Institute filed an emergency application to Justice Elena Kagan on the U.S. Supreme Court, asking her to quickly consider their request to stop this ban as officials finalize the statewide ballot, like in the next couple of days. Vicki?
I'm glad they're going to appeal, but I want to go back to something that Ken said. And that was, this is a policy question. I would argue normally that it is a policy question, but what the legislature did in this particular ban was to appropriate money, which made it referendum proof, which means the voters could not have a say, unlike in 1964 and the 2001 ban. This was purposefully done by the legislature to prevent the voters from taking action to repeal it. But the voters are really lucky this year because there is a constitutional amendment question on the ballot, promote the vote, which would guarantee in our Constitution the right to vote straight party ticket, the right for no reason absentee ballots, and all of the things that the legislature was asked to pass along with this straight party ticket voting ban failed to do.
You've now anticipated my question to you to explain to some of the proposals on this promote the vote measure. Ken, the campaigning for the proposal starts now. What are the arguments against it, and who's likely to fight promote the vote?
Well, one of the arguments really isn't related so much to the ballot question specifically. It's whether or not you ought to have things like that in the Constitution, which virtually cannot be changed except through another constitutional amendment. Probably the one policy piece that people are going to get agitated about is same-day voter registration. In other words, you can register to vote on election day. The no reason absentee voting piece of it, many Republicans wanted the legislature to actually do that. Ruth Johnson, current Secretary of State, has supported it. Current Lieutenant Governor nominee Lisa Posthumous-Lyons supported it when she was in the legislature. So there are some pieces that some Republicans actually like. But the one part of it that causes aggravation among Republicans is going to be the same day voter registration, which they believe could be subject to fraud.
Vicki, you want to respond to that?
Yes. I think it's very sad that we're talking about this, access to the ballot, in terms of Republicans and Democrats. This is an American right of every citizen to be able to cast their ballot on Election Day. And the fact that we've had voter registration purges, that we're talking about whether Republicans like this or not, really goes to the heart of why this does need to be in the Constitution. The fact that a Republican-led legislature on several occasions has gone to the far reaches to say no straight party ticket voting and to start to purge voter lists is a real problem. And I think that the right of the people to cast their ballot and to have their say on Election Day is very, very key to what it means to be an American in a free society. And so I think this is a great ballot proposal. I will be supporting it, and I think all voters should. And with new technology, there's no reason why we can't have same-day voter registration. We're not living back before there were computers and election lists and all of those things. So I don't think it's really a problem to verify a voter's residency through same-day voter registration.
Finally, just before we started chatting with you, I asked the governor who he'd be voting for in November, and he said he'd decide that when the day comes. The Democrats have already been making a big deal out of the fact Governor Snyder hasn't endorsed fellow Republican Bill Schuette. Now he won't even say whether he'll vote for Schuette. Does any of that really matter? Vicki?
In the big scheme of things, I don't think it really matters, except it does point out the schism in the Republican Party.
Ken?
Well, yeah, it does. Anything matters in a tight race, which Schuette has, and so everything matters. And so, yes, I think it does matter. I mean, it might sort of represent the fact there are other Republicans or like-minded of the governor who maybe are reluctant to support Schuette. But in a tight race, you need all the help you can get.
That's Ken Sikkema. He's a former Republican legislator. And Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Good to talk to both of you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Lester.
Ken joined us by Skype. Coming up, in response to the gunman who killed 17 students and staff members at a high school in Parkland, Florida, the Michigan legislature has added money to a fund in the state police budget that's meant to keep schools safe.
The amount of money that we received in our region would not have been possible with the multiple year cuts that we've all been enduring.
We'll show how schools are using that grant money in about 5 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. This weather has been outrageous. It's after Labor Day. We're still hitting the 90s.
It is not fall, so we are not going to drink a fall drink.
So you were inspired, though, to fix a drink for us.
Because it's been so hot, I decided to take us in a tiki direction today. Also taking a little inspiration here from some research I've been doing for an upcoming class on beer cocktails.
Yeah, beer's not the first thing I think about when I think about tiki drinks.
So if you think about it, a lot of, especially these hoppy IPAs, have some really nice citrusy notes. Some even have pineapple-y kinds of notes. And this drink actually came about because two bartenders out on the West Coast had a keg with just a little bit of an IPA left, and they were trying to, like, use it up. And so they were like, oh, let's put it in a cocktail. So they call this the Strange Brew, and I thought it would be a good drink for a hot day.
So did you use a Michigan beer?
I did, of course. I actually, on another hot day this week, I went to the store and I got an assorted pack of singles to try some new-to-me Michigan beers. And this one is called Dawn of Vim, and it is a fresh IPA from Brewery Vivant out in Grand Rapids.
Which we visited and had fun there.
That's right. We like their beers a lot, and I like this one a lot, too.
Any other Michigan ingredients?
So our gin, this is a gin-based tiki drink, and our gin that we're using is the Gin Stash Gin from Rusted Crow Spirits in Dearborn.
I don't know that.
They've been around for quite a while now, but we just haven't had a chance to use their spirits up until now. But this is really fun. They were founded by a tattoo artist, and that really is reflected in their labels because they have these fantastical labels. This one is called Gin Stash, as a play on words with the gin stash that everyone had during Prohibition, but it features a guy with a fantastic mustache.
And a nice bowler as well. Well, that sounds interesting. How do you make this drink?
So in a cocktail shaker, I combine 2 ounces of gin, 3/4 of an ounce of Velvet Falernum, and that's a tiki ingredient that's sort of a spice liqueur of sorts, and then 1 ounce of fresh pineapple juice. You can use the stuff from the can if that's all you have. It is better with fresh. And then 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, and I shook that all up, strained it into a tiki mug. You could use an old-fashioned or a highball glass. Added my 2.5 ounces of the IPA, and then topped it up with some crushed ice and gave it a beautiful mint garnish.
Yeah, you know, when you pulled out that little machine to crush your ice, I was thinking, where is her, you know, her blender, her mixer, something like that? What is that?
So this is a isomat, and I bought a regular hand crush ice machine a while ago, the one that you can go into a store and buy right now, and they're horrible. They're made of plastic, they fall apart, they get rust all over your ice. They're just really not good. I have an electric ice crusher in my basement when I need bigger volumes, but it's finicky and it's hard to work with. So I actually did some research online and found out that the best ice crushers to get are these vintage ones from the 1950s and 60s that are this Isomat brand. And they're all over eBay, and you can get one for $10 for the inexpensive ones, all the way up to more for the sought-after varieties.
A vintage ice machine seems perfect for a tiki drink somehow. Should we have a taste?
I snuck one already, so you go first this time.
Oh. So it's like the taste of the beer, the gin, and the pineapple all hit at the same time. Mm-hmm. It was really interesting because usually you get that front taste, the aftertaste, something like that, but they all hit exactly at the same time. It was an interesting experience. I liked it, but it was surprising.
I agreed. It is this remarkably consistent tasting cocktail, which I think is great for a day like today. It's not fancy or it doesn't make you think. It's just something that you really want to sip on a hot day.
All right. That's the Strange Brew. Tasty and very summery. As long as we still have a little summer left, we might as well enjoy it. Cheers.
Cheers.
Mass school shootings have led school boards across the nation to think about what can be done to make schools more safe. In Michigan, there's been a small fund in the Michigan State Police budget intended for grants to use for schools to use for safety measures. This year, the legislature increased that fund from $2 million last year to $25 million this year. That increase was a reaction to the gunman at a high school in Parkland, Florida, who killed 17 students and staff members and injured 17 others. Joining us now is Deputy Director of Michigan State Police, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Kolinsky, who is the commander of the Specialized Services Bureau. Welcome.
Thank you.
So how are schools using this grant money?
Well, schools are using it in different ways, and this also goes back to 2003 when we started pushing Homeland Security grant dollars to the school districts or the different schools. So it's really going to depend on how far they have come since 2003. It's open to public and non-public schools, school districts, and intermediate school districts. There's a few things they have to do, but some of the eligible items include physical security enhancement equipment. So that could be door locks, proximity access, car readers, motion detection systems, lighting, etc. Anything that they can do to improve or harden the exterior access points of the schools could be public address systems, inspection and screening systems, shatterproof glass, even signage for emergency exits or visitor registration areas, fences, gates, mobile telephone applications that provide the ability to communicate with personnel on site as well as connect them to 911, and even doing school safety assessments, which is really where we started, even as far back as 2003.
Well, that's a lot.
It is.
How much money can a school get in this grant?
Well, there's two different programs. with this grant. And the program area one is limited to $25,000 for an individual school or $250,000 for a school district. The second program is limited to $1 million. But with that comes a 25% cash match requirement.
Mm-hmm. So I assume that school districts are not all at the same place in securing their buildings and so forth. So what are the priorities for a school? What are the critical starting places?
Well, the priorities are to ensure that you have certain things in place. And that's a great question. But in the wake of these violent events, emergency responders, our emergency management coordinators, our school administrators and educators and others involved with ensuring a safe environment, they have to reevaluate potential threats and preventative measures to mitigate the threats. And then we have to work with our school administrators to prevent further acts of violence in our schools. More specifically, is that before you invest in, say, an internal closed-circuit television system that just records events, do you have your outside doors locked? Is your outside secure? Is your facility hardened? Do you require people to look at a camera and buzz in before they come in? Do you have a visitor access program in place to ensure that the people that are in your building are supposed to be in your building? So this is where we do the assessments, and it's important that school officials work with the local emergency management coordinators, local emergency responders, and that they have this planning team made up of multiple disciplines to include the schools, the educators, and et cetera, to make sure that they put those things in place in the right priority order. And it's going to depend on how hardened their school is in the first place.
Now, I've read in some rural school districts, they're concerned because they are so far away from first responders. They might be a 20-minute drive from the nearest police station. Is that going to be a different approach than a school that might have a 3-minute response?
It's not going to be a different approach. However, that should increase the work that they're doing on this. It's so critical that schools are prepared, they plan, they train, and they exercise. Even if you are in a major city, it's going to take time for responders to get there. We're not going to wait. We're going to come in. But if a school, the teachers, the students, the parents are not trained, that they don't know what to do, it's going to cause chaos and confusion. Everybody has to be on the same page. Everybody has to be engaged in this process, regardless if it's an urban or rural area.
Let's talk about a couple of logistical things here. Is there a grant application deadline?
Yes, there is a grant application deadline, and it is coming up very quickly. They're due at 12 noon on September 13th.
Yeah, that is quick.
And I know sometimes these grant applications scare people away. This is a very simple grant application that they can fill out. It does not take very long. It is important to know that there's certain things they have to have in place, and all schools need to have an emergency operations plan that has been updated after August 1st, 2017, and aligns with the State of Michigan Emergency Operations Plan guidance that we put out back in 2014. Again, we started in 2003 starting to get some requirements in place, but in 2014, after Governor Snyder put a Safe Schools Initiative together, we've been kind of using that as our baseline for schools to ensure their emergency operations plan has everything that's needed. And that includes things of the initial response, assignment of responsibilities, how they're going to communicate, emergency contacts, having school maps, all the things that are needed in these plans.
The last couple of years, there have been a lot more schools applying for the grant money than you had grant money. You've got more this time, but I'm wondering if some of those schools who did get a grant that's smaller than they needed to accomplish their goals, can they apply again?
Yes, I'm not aware of anything that doesn't allow them to apply, but keep in mind we're trying to get all the schools to some levels here. So if we have a school that doesn't even have locks that are working effectively, and unfortunately that is the case in some areas, we're going to make sure that we get the locks in that facility before we give another school money for, again, closed circuit television cameras. A lot of people will look at that thinking that's the answer. Unless you have somebody full-time dedicated to monitoring that, that doesn't mean a secretary has one more duty. They have the monitor there. They're really just going to record the event, or during a response, if we have live access to it, would be beneficial. But we're going to make sure that we harden that facility first from the outside in. We definitely take a layered approach to our security.
Let's bottom line this. What fraction of Michigan schools have prepared for an active shooter or other violent attack by installing equipment to harden the school security?
That I don't know. That's a great question. This is part of some of the things the governor has put in place with his executive order, which established a school safety task force, and for us to start looking at some or pulling some recommendations together so we can start doing a better job auditing these schools to ensure that they, in fact, are doing this. Having a wife as an educator, I understand the amount of work educators, teachers, principals, superintendents have to do to educate our children. We just need to make sure that we do more and do a better job with getting them this information and helping them get those plans in place.
Lieutenant Colonel Chris Kolinsky is commander of the Specialized Services Bureau and a deputy director of the Michigan State Police. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, sir.
Let's turn to the school district that received the largest grant from these funds in the last round at $127,000. Dan Reator is the superintendent of the Eastern Upper Peninsula Intermediate School District. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about your district. How large, how many schools, how many students?
Our intermediate school district is about 4,000 square miles. That's over three counties, Chippewa, Luce, and Mackinac counties, all on the eastern end of the Upper Peninsula. We have 20 school districts, and that's about 7,000 students. So a lot of space, many school entities, not very many people.
How did you spend that grant money?
Well, most of the money was spent on building access systems where you're probably familiar with local schools. You go up, you push a button, the doors are all locked. Someone has to physically push a button to allow you to enter the building. There's an intercom. Some systems have video where they can determine that, yes, this is Mrs. Jones. She's coming in to volunteer in the second grade classroom, that kind of thing. So someone has the responsibility of verifying that that person should, in fact, be in the building. So with our districts being very remote, if something bad were to happen, the response time would be not very great from our state police or county sheriff's departments or village or town police agencies. School districts work together on applying for this grant so that they could hopefully secure their buildings a little bit better.
I assume that $127,000 didn't solve all the problems for all the schools you cover.
That's correct. Again, most of that money was spent on the door access systems. A small piece of it was spent on the ballistic film that you can put on windows that would at least slow down a person trying to enter the building with lethal means, whether shooting into a building or using some type of force to try and break through the windows. Most of our schools have those barriers in place now as a result of the grant. So we were very pleased to be able to receive the grant. Our local districts worked together on a variety of issues in the Eastern Upper Peninsula, and this is one example of that. In fact, one of our local superintendents, Tom McKee, at Whitefish Township School, took the lead on writing the grant, and so we coordinated with all the districts in our region and created a list, and the primary need last year was, again, for those school entry, door entry systems.
How helpful has the Michigan State Police been in helping your schools understand the priorities they need to accomplish to make the schools more secure?
Oh, they were tremendous. For this grant program, they had a contact person that was always available when we had questions. Overall, generally speaking, schools work closely with their local police and fire agencies on how they might respond in the event of some tragic incident. Lots of planning takes place. There are tabletop exercises. All of those things have happened over the last, 10, 12, 15 years. It helps identify what maybe the weaknesses are or how could we improve the security in our own building. When something happens someplace else, in the world or in the United States or in another school situation where there was a security issue, our local districts spend time reviewing their own plans and, what if that happened here? How would we respond? How could we address that where we are? And so the state police, the counties, all of our police and fire agencies have been very supportive. They've been very available to us and willing to come and talk about security issues. And again, they have tabletop exercises. Some districts actually go through mock situations so that they can practice how they might respond. Again, over the last 10, 12 years,
you know, we've developed lists of things that we would do if the money was available.
Well, let's talk about the money, because before the grant funding was available, some schools started making some serious investment in security, pulling from their own budgets. Would that have been possible in your district?
No. The amount of money that we received in our region, $127,000, would not have been possible with the multiple year cuts that we've all been enduring. That's not to say that security is not a high enough priority, but when you're making the decision to buy a new textbook series or new software or new computer equipment or a new school bus as opposed to the door system, these are difficult decisions that have to be made by local school leaders. So the availability of that grant was just invaluable, and so it allowed the districts to make those improvements. You know, they have longer lists, so as we move forward and hopefully future years, the state police grant will be available.
Yeah, it is this year. There's more money. Yeah. September 13th deadline. Are you going to apply?
Yes, absolutely. We have assembled our superintendents. We meet monthly and we talk about a variety of issues, and one of them is applying for the school safety grant. So we are assembling the list. We have indicated our desire to apply, and we're doing so as a region.
Dan Riotor is superintendent of the Eastern Upper Peninsula Intermediate School District, which was one of 25 public school districts and 24 non-public school districts and 3 charter schools awarded grants last year to help make schools more secure. As we mentioned, the legislature increased funding from $2 million last year to $25 million this year. Dan Riotor, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, the national prisoner strike ends on Sunday, which coincides with the 47th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising. Have things gotten much better since then? We'll find out in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan's Children's Protective Services has been falling short. A report by the state's Auditor General lists 17 serious infractions, including failing to do criminal background checks of foster parents and not correctly following up in cases of alleged abuse or neglect. Joining me now is Joshua Kay. He's with the Child Advocacy Law Clinic at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Of these shortcomings by Children's Protective Services that the Auditor General reported, which are the ones that concern you the most?
There are a few. One is the delay in initiating investigations. Another is the set of problems with completing investigations completely and promptly, proper documentation. All of those point to significant child safety concerns.
So one of the things that the report indicated was a lack of background checks, a lack of check on whether people have been in the system at all. What kind of problems does that cause?
I think that's a serious issue, because it's only through looking at the history of a case that CPS can determine what the level of risk to a child is and what needs to be done about it. And, you know, often a given case is really a tip of the iceberg situation, and they need to dig deeply, and that includes the history, in order to accurately and completely assess what's going on in a case. So I think that's very concerning.
CPS says they've corrected or made improvements since research for this audit was done. But these 17 infractions are on top of a record of failing to keep Michigan children safe. An investigative report by Lansing State Journal outlined a lot of disturbing cases and revealed data where dozens of kids in the state's care were hurt or died in a year's time. What's going on?
Well, I think that CPS is tasked with something that's very complex and very difficult. I think there are resource issues. There may be training issues. There are certainly issues of follow-through. This report documented problems with the investigations and the follow-through and oversight of the investigations. So at all levels, there are concerns.
So is this staff shortages?
It's possible that staff shortages contribute. That data is not clear in this report.
I'm just wondering, if I were a legislator And I was seeing this problem. I'd be wanting to know, how do I solve it? You know, what would you do if you were talking to a legislator who had to vote on this and figure out how to fix CPS?
So I think that certainly budgets need to be looked at, but within CPS, I think that's where perhaps the larger set of problems are. Specifically, CPS is doing a complex job, and there are laws, and there are policies, and there are tools at their disposal to do that complex job. And what this report is pointing to are failures to follow the laws, follow the policies, and use the tools properly that are at their disposal. So I really see it as something within the agency that needs to get fixed. There's probably one other important point to make, which is that I don't think that the suitable response is for CPS to suddenly become more severe and take more kids out of the home. The suitable response is to accurately assess what needs to be done in each case. That's the really important thing. The failures to use the risk assessment tool that they use resulted sometimes in too low of a risk assessment, but also sometimes they inaccurately determined that risk was high, and that can lead to too much intervention. So one response that sometimes happens, whether it's a bad event like a child death in care or a child death due to abuse, is that CPS clamps down on the families rather than actually correcting itself, and that would be concerning.
You know, I feel for the people who have this job because it's got to be tough. It's got to be emotionally, this has to be taxing on them because they're dealing with families in crisis much of the time. What kind of help do these people in the field need to get the job done right?
I think that certainly the stresses of the job, and they are severe, would contribute to turnover. And so I think they do need a lot more support within the agency in order to retain personnel and ensure that they can do their work well and on a consistent basis.
CPS says it's on it. It's correcting the things that led to these most recent infractions. Given its history, how confident are you that the children under the care of the state of Michigan are going to be safer?
I would hope that there's going to be follow-up after this report to ensure that CPS is instituting changes to keep kids safer. Without that oversight, given the history here, given how long the department has been under even a federal consent decree because of how foster kids were being cared for, I'm not confident that changes will be significant or lasting unless there's that oversight.
Joshua Kay is a clinical assistant professor of law at the Child Advocacy Law Clinic at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Lester.
Prisoners have been on strike. There was a call for prisoners to stop working, hold sit-ins, go on hunger strikes, and other actions until the set of 10 demands is met. Joining me now is historian Heather Ann Thompson. She is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. She's also a professor of history at the University of Michigan. Welcome back to Stateside.
Great to be here again.
Let's get to the basics of this. What has triggered this strike by prisoners?
Well, what we don't realize is that prisoners protest every day, and they've always protested over the same thing, terribly inhumane conditions in prisons across this country. Michigan is no exception. And this time, they decided to do it in concert. They decided to make a national call that went out to every state, and prisoners across this country have stood together during this two-week period to call attention to the terrible conditions that we as taxpayers fund and need to know what's going on.
So we're in the last days of the time period set out for this strike. It's hard to get information, but I'm hoping you have some context or better ones than I have. What have you been hearing about it?
Well, what we know is that there have been many states that have gone out, from New Mexico to California to South Carolina, but it's not a surprise. We don't know more. Prisons are hugely closed to the public, despite the fact they're public institutions, and so we need to rely on folks telling their family members, who in turn tell the media, We have to wait for some time often to know exactly how many people protested. This happened again in 2016 in Michigan, and it took literally months before we understood how many folks had stood together to call attention to these conditions.
Because they have these 10 demands. Can you outline, without going down the whole laundry list, what do they want?
Well, the demands are both very intimate and very general, very policy-oriented. The more intimate demands are to improve the conditions, the direct conditions of confinement that people experience every day. No one's asking to get out. They're asking to simply be treated as human beings inside. So that could be everything from, you know, basic medical care to food to not having abuse in the prison. But then there's also some bigger demands, public demands for sentencing reform. We now have more people in prison than at any moment in U.S. history and more than any other country. So there's a call for us to revisit our sentencing policy and to really think about the racial disproportionality of who's in prison, too. This is a key demand.
I want to talk about that a little more a little later. I've read in several reports that the prisoners are charging their enduring slave labor by the prisons. What do they mean by that?
Well, I don't think that most folks on the outside understand that we do have a provision in our Constitution to keep people in slavery, and that is if they are convicted of a crime. And even though that is constitutional, it is nevertheless immoral in the sense that you're forcing people to labor, but you're not giving them any remuneration that they in turn need to pay for their kids on the outside, to pay for their ability to do well when they get out of prison. So it's literally slave labor. It's exploitative labor where no workers on the outside are getting paid to make those cabinets or those dentures or those ball caps, and no one's getting paid on the inside either. So only state institutions and private companies benefit.
So in a lot of cases, though, these prisoners aren't forced to work. They volunteer to work knowing that they're going to get 13 or 16 cents an hour. So who's problem is it if the prisoners are volunteering for it?
That's a great point. So the key issue is that work is not the problem. No one is complaining about work. Work is actually good for all of us. It gives us time to pass the day, gives us skills, gives value in its own right. The problem is the exploitation. And you're absolutely right. People want to get out of these tiny 6x8 cells to do productive labor, but they wish that they then had enough money that they could, for example, afford extra food to get a more nutritional diet in the prison.
Are prison industries a big moneymaker for some states?
Indeed. I would invite any one of the listeners to go on Michigan's website or any other state website and look up the correctional industries and just click on the catalog. You might be absolutely stunned by the number of products that are made that, even if they're being sold to other state institutions, are oftentimes things that used to be made on the outside and no longer are.
And is that compensation that I talked about a minute ago, pennies on the hour, is that typical? Or do they get, does it vary from state to state
it
or
totally
from institutions?
Varies. Yeah, it totally varies. And the best case scenario are prison jobs that are created under a program called PIE. And those are supposed to be a prevailing minimum wage. But once everything is deducted and all these loopholes, basically no one ever really makes a minimum wage. And in many, many states, you're literally talking about pennies on the dollar and sometimes no pay at all to do very dangerous work. For example, cleaning up after the BP oil spill or fighting fires, California.
Yeah. For a dollar an hour.
Exactly.
One ex-offender said on Democracy Now, on the same program you were on, that, quote, it's kind of like a modern-day plantation situation specifically targeting poor people and most especially the most marginalized community, black and brown and LGBT community, end quote. What can you tell us about a statement like that?
Well, I think it's just the clear recognition that it's not just anyone who's in our prisons. If it were true that those who committed the crime did the time equally and there was equal justice under the law, the prisons would not be so racially disparate. And then when you throw forced labor on top of it, or at least exploited labor, it does start to resemble the plantations of old where folks have no choice but to do what they're told to do.
So this strike's been going on for, well, we're almost to the end of it. It ends on September 9th. What are various corrections agencies doing? How are they responding to it?
Well, that remains to be seen. Corrections always will tell you that there's nothing going on and there's nothing here to see. But at the end of the day, we know that there is a real crisis brewing in most American prisons. There was a terrible event in South Carolina where folks were killed. We have terrible conditions that guards also know exist. And so right now we're seeing a real tipping point. It'll be interesting to see whether Corrections finally realizes that you've got to run these places humanely or they will continue to explode.
Now, some of these demands can only be met by Congress or state legislatures. The politicians, I'm wondering if they're paying attention to the strike and the prisoners' demands.
Well, I think they are. I mean, I certainly get calls from legislators in addition to journalists to talk about this because legislators want to know if this is a just system, why is it so fraught with tension and conflict and periodic rebellions, as we're seeing right now. And I do think that there is some goodwill to try to fix this, but we can't fix it until we fully understand the problem, and we can't understand the problem until we shine some light on what these places are really like.
So this was an odd period. It's like 2.5 weeks. It started on August 21st, ends on September 9th. What's significant about those dates?
Well, this shows you, actually, that the folks on the inside are perhaps more aware of history even than some of us on the outside. The dates chosen were very significant. August 21st, when it began, was the date when a prisoner by the name of George Jackson was killed in California. And he was really an icon for prisoner rights. And so when he died on August 21st, that sent a shockwave across prisons back in 1971. And then it ends on August 9th, which was the beginning of the Attica prisoner uprising of 1971, again, one of the most important prisoner protests in American history. So those dates are symbolic to folks on the inside, for sure.
So in a GQ interview with you, the interviewer Luke Darby wrote that the prisoners striking today warned that prison conditions have gotten so bad that another Attica is ripe to happen. Remind us about Attica. What was the aftermath of that uprising?
Well, I think those are really sage words. Attica happened because the folks inside kept going through the democratic process to ask for basic human rights. They were ignored. Eventually, they erupted to almost 1,300 men in protest, tried to negotiate better conditions. And then the state of New York came in and essentially killed 39 men, hostages and guards, and shot 128 and tortured countless more. And we don't want that. We want to fix these problems before they happen.
Have we seen a simmering like that? I know there was a problem up in the UP at one of the Michigan correction facilities. Are we seeing a little bubbling like that around, or is that constant all the time?
Well, I think it's constant all the time, but there is no question that since 2016, we're seeing an uptick. In Michigan, the Kinross prison, there was an utter explosion in 2016 because of these terrible conditions. As I mentioned, the Lee Correctional Facility in South Carolina, prisoners ended up dying at the hands of other prisoners. There was no administration help. There was no folks there maintaining peace in the facility. And those guys have been locked down since April. This is a tinderbox, and there's no state that's exempt from it.
So are we on the brink of an Attica?
I think so. I very much fear so.
And I guess there's no way to predict how to stop that. We know what they want. In fact, one of the things I found interesting was it's a lot about rehabilitation and a chance for Pell Grants to get some school so when they get out, they've got a future. And the right to vote, which I'm not sure any politician is going to go with, but, you know,
well, the solutions,
it's on the table now, right?
The solutions are easy. We simply need to treat folks on the inside who may have committed a harm the way we would treat our own children if they committed a harm. That is, with grace, with the idea that folks will return to the community and we want them to return better and whole.
You say that, but in so many cases, these are people who have committed really heinous crimes, and people don't understand why we should give them any kind of a break since they've murdered or hurt people.
Well, and I hear that a lot, and I think the response to that is actually not very complicated. There are indeed folks that have committed egregious harms. The majority have not, but there are indeed those folks. And again, I would say that even if you woke up tomorrow and you learned that your child had committed the unthinkable act, the question would be, what would you want to happen next? You would want them to take responsibility. You would want them to make it right. You certainly wouldn't want them to do it again. And the only way that any of that would happen is to have them in a system that made them whole and better and face what happened, not to torture them. I mean, no no one would support that. No one would support that kind of abuse if we just bring it a little closer to home.
Heather Ann Thompson is a historian at the University of Michigan, the author of Blood in the Water, the Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and its Legacy, which was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for History last year. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Take care.
The man at the center of a 50-year-old Star-Spangled Banner controversy will return to Detroit tomorrow night.
Ladies and gentlemen, your attention, please. Please rise and join in the singing of our national anthem, which will be played by Merle Albee's band and will be sung by Jose Feliciano.
He'll sing the anthem before the Tigers take on the St. Louis Cardinals, the same team the Tigers beat in the 1968 to win the World Series. In Game 5 of that series, hit singer Jose Feliciano delivered a daring rendition of our national anthem, and it set people into an uproar over its non-traditional sound. We're going to leave you with a little of Feliciano's rendition from 50 years ago. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening to Stateside.
Oh, see, can you see by the dawn?